All right. So, speed version, going backwards. We were working through Judges together before my trips had started. And in the time of the Judges, there was people that God would raise up, and we would see this cycle occur over and over again. The Judges would appear, and they would speak a message something like, "You guys are headed in the wrong direction. You're moving away from God. That's what got you in so much trouble. Turn your hearts back to God. He will forgive you, and now things are going to get better again. And now we can push back against our enemies and get back on task with what God has us to do." There's the speed Reader's Digest version of Judges, okay? There's a lot more to it, but that's the basics. And some of our favorite characters are in there who God raises up, and he teaches them lessons about himself and themselves, people like Gideon and Samson, and we see these great stories of tragedy and triumph and all these things going on in there with this mega theme, though, of God desires his people to repent and turn back to him and get their lives back on track. Now, God had led them to the promised land, but they had to believe that they truly were supposed to be in the promised land and do the things necessary to claim the promised land and live in the promised land and live in that land of milk and honey, right? But there were still a lot of enemies, a lot of battles to fight, a lot of things to overcome. And you can either be the influencee or the influencer. And it's a challenge that everybody faces, right? Even to this day. We've even got language for it: peer pressure. Don't fall, we tell our kids, don't fall to peer pressure. We tell ourselves, even as adults sometimes, we need to be reminded, don't fall to peer pressure. You're starting to be more like them instead of godly. Well, the Israelites fell to peer pressure, and they looked around at the pagan cultures around them, and they said, "Man, it would be great if we could have a king. Everybody else has a king. Why can't I have a king?" And they were reminded that you have a king. You're just forgetting who your king is. You're looking for a king that for some reason you want to be able to see and feel and touch and, by the way, be subject to and ordered around by and have to be under their whims. And that's really not in your best interest because the God of the universe wants to be your king, wants to be your sovereign Lord. He's already sitting on the throne. Let him rule you. He is the only good king. That's great, but we want a king like the pagans have a king. We want a king that'll be set up and can lead us and guide us and rule over us. And they were warned. Samuel told them, as God's mouthpiece, "We'll give you what you want. You're not going to like it, but you can have what you want. You're going to wish we could go back, but we'll give you what you want." God is like that. He allows us a certain amount of freedom, and because of our free will, he will allow us to make choices, not because it's his best interest, not because it's plan A, but because God gives us a dignity of free will and choice, even if it's a really, really poor choice. So then we fast forward to the book of 1 Samuel, where we see the idea of kingship put upon them, and they fall in love with this idea of a king, and so God raises up a king for them, and initially this looks great because Saul is big, and Saul is strong, and Saul looks to be the part. But inward, in his heart, Saul has some issues. And one of the biggest issues he has is fear instead of faith. And if we operate by fear, fear will always win out over our faith if we allow it to rest in our hearts and plant seeds and till that soil. And the way we till and kind of water that soil of fear is speaking into it and speaking it out and bringing it to life. So what does that look like? Saul would say in his heart and in his mind, "We can't do this. We can't do that. We can't overcome this. I can't tell my people no. What'll happen then? They might not like me anymore. They might get mad at me. They might want a different king. Well, I know God really wants this to happen, but you ever operated by fear? You recognizing that voice I'm speaking about, worrying about what will people think? So Saul gets to a place where they've got mighty victories going on. And God tells him one basic thing. I will go before you. I will make you victorious. You will defeat your enemies. However, take no plunder. Take nothing. And the people have a mighty victory, and God helps them win the battle, and the enemies are fleeing about them because they've heard the rumors of the armies of the living God of Israel, and they want nothing to do with those people, so they're always in disarray when they have to face them. And then they decide, we've earned some of this plunder. We should be able to take it. And so they take it, and they keep it, once again falling out of God's favor. And Saul, when questioned about it, when Samuel, the prophet, comes up and speaks to him about it and then says, hey, what gives? He says, as most of us do when confronted with something we've done wrong, we use deflection. Instead of answering the question and talking about what we know the person really wants to hear, we're hoping if we say enough words and babble enough that we'll distract them and we can move on to lunch or something else. You're not the first person to think of that. Saul was pretty good at it. So Saul says, hey, did you hear about the mighty victory? It went just as you said. You know, God was with us and we blasted those guys and it was awesome. And now Samuel, also being a human being like us, liked to use a little bit of humor like we do. So instead of him just saying directly what he was saying, he says, what is that bleating of the sheep and the mooing of the cows that I hear in the background? Oh, yeah, those, let me see, I don't want to take responsibility as the leader over all this and the king over all this, so the people really wanted to keep them, and you know how those guys are. They love sheep, and they love cattle, and they love stuff like that, and, you know, I couldn't stand in the way of that. You see? This all sounds so familiar. Human nature is just so stinking familiar. It just keeps the cycle, right? Over and over and over again. So this is what we see going on as the precursor to our situation here that we walk into. So the Lord looks at the heart, and the biblical dictionary definition here of this would be the inward moral and spiritual life, the emotion, the will, and the reason. So I'm not talking about that thing sitting in your chest beating rapidly on and off, especially as I say something that convicts your heart and then your other heart starts beating a little harder. We're talking about this part of you, the inward moral and spiritual life, the emotion, the will, and the reason. So we'll look first here at Saul, and Saul starts off small, but then he ultimately finishes small. He starts out small, and he ultimately finishes small. And his first concern was about his worthiness, and in 9:21 we see this as we go in 1 Samuel 9:21. Saul answered, "But am I not a Benjamite from the smallest tribe of Israel? And is not my clan the least of all the clans of the tribe of Benjamin? Why do you say such a thing to me?" And this is after Samuel came to him and was anointing him as the king over Israel. And this was his response to this. Now, on one hand, there's a humility that we like. There's not a brashness, not a jumping into this like, yeah, you've got the right guy. It's pretty obvious. I'm head and shoulders above the people around me, and I'm your man. So there was something about him that was a bit humble that we liked, but there was also a fear already built into his character, which said, especially in relationship to his tribe and his people, but we're small. We don't matter too much. We don't account for too much. And even amongst the Benjamites, who are not looked at as powerhouses like some of the other tribes, like Judah, I mean, we're just Benjamites. And even amongst the Benjamites, my family, my clan, we're pretty small within that group. So his thing was, there's not much to me, there's not much to my family, and he was focused on him. And we talked about this in training ground, that that's the wrong focus. We're not supposed to be focused on us and our family, but we're supposed to be focused on God himself. He's the one that makes things happen. He's the one that works through stuff. So Saul starts with a concern about his worthiness. And you say, well, he was being humble, and surely there's, you know, concern about this, and how could he have learned this lesson? We don't have to go very far to see this has already been a lesson that somebody else that he would have already known about had learned. And I mentioned his name a few minutes ago. Remember a guy named Gideon? You remember the words Gideon spoke? Do they sound a little bit familiar? I see the same spirit functioning here, speaking against another person of God. Same spirit, speaking the same words, because the reaction is exactly the same. Gideon, when spoken to, Gideon is told, hey, I want you to take and lead the people against the enemies. And you have too many people. So I want you to do this to whittle it down. And pretty soon they had knocked off their really nice size army, which was still a lot smaller than the enemy. And they had knocked that thousands and tens of thousands down to 300 guys. And God said, now we can do something with your 300 guys. And Gideon's like, oi, what do we do now? And yet God wanted to do something special because he loves doing things like this, that we have to depend on him more and more and more. Saul already knew this story. And yet here he is speaking, yeah, but we're too small. He had this concern about his own worthiness. Am I really worthy? Am I the guy that you should be calling out to do something like this? But ultimately, it says that he is anointed and filled by the Spirit to accomplish really great things. Chapter 10, then Saul took a flask of oil, poured it on Saul's head, kissed him, saying, has not the Lord anointed you leader over his inheritance? And notice the words that he uses here. Invoking the name of the Lord over the situation, reminding him of what's going on here. Has not the Lord anointed you leader over his inheritance? See, God's the one that has the real stake in this whole thing. We look at it sometimes about our reputation and our stake and what does that mean to us, and that's the wrong viewpoint. It's about God. It's always about God. And he's saying, I have a stake in the game. This is my inheritance. This is my prophecy. These are my words I spoke. This is my covenant I made with Abraham. And yeah, it was a long time ago, but it's being fulfilled now, and you get to be a part of it. And he anoints him, and he kisses him, and he reminds him prophetically, this lineage, this promise, this covenant has been going on for a long time. You get to walk in it. 5-8 says what he's going to do after that. You'll go to Gibeah of God, where there is a Philistine outpost. As you approach the town, you'll meet a procession of prophets coming down from the high place with lyres, tambourines, flutes, harps being played before them, and they will be prophesying. The Spirit of the Lord will come upon you in power, and you will prophesy with them, and you will be changed into a different person. He wasn't ready-made. He wasn't ready to go. He was God's instrument, but he needed to be changed into a different person to be used. Once these signs are fulfilled, do whatever your hand finds you to do, for God is with you. Nothing can stop you when these words are spoken over you like this. When the word of the living God comes on you and fear flies away from you and you hear this voice, I love this prophetic utterance that's being spoken over him in this. Do whatever your hand finds you to do. He's just kind of saying, look, don't worry about it. Yeah, you haven't been a leader in the past. You haven't been a king in the past. You haven't had to govern generals. You haven't had to command armies. You haven't had to do all these things. Do whatever your hand finds you to do. Why? Not because you're great, because God is with you now. God is with you. Go down ahead of me to Gilgal. I will surely come down to you to sacrifice burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, but you must wait 7 days till I come to you and tell you what you are to do. So at this point in his life, Saul has everything that he needs to walk in victory. Because you only need one thing. That is the Spirit of the living God walking with you. Now, back in these days, in the Old Testament, the Spirit of God would come upon people for a time and a purpose. It was like a season. It wasn't like our viewpoint, our theological view of the Holy Spirit today. It's the same Holy Spirit functioned differently between back in the Old Testament when the Spirit would come upon people for a time and a purpose. Samson, it said the Spirit of the mighty God came upon him and gave him the mightiest strength anybody had ever walked with. In this case, the Spirit of the living God comes upon Saul and says, hey, whatever your hand finds to do, do it because I'm with you and we'll make this happen. Just your part is one thing. You don't have to be the best king, the best general, the best governor, the best person able to come up with war plans. Just be obedient. When I speak to you, and sometimes I'm going to speak to you through the prophetic voice of Samuel or other prophets, when I speak to you, do what I tell you to do. That's it. Don't veer the left. Don't veer the right. Do what I tell you to do. He was set up for success, not failure. God's perfect will would have been for Saul to walk in his sovereign will, be on point, be on purpose, be a part of the kingdom. It was not his purpose for him to fail. Free will steps in. What happens next? Saul was disobedient and unfaithful, and I'll posit to you ultimately it was because his heart was not right with God. It says, as we jump forward to 1 Samuel 13, 9, and he said, bring me the burnt offerings and the fellowship offerings. And Saul offered up the burnt offerings. Just as he had finished making the offerings, Samuel arrived. Saul went out to greet him. What have you done? Asked Samuel. Saul replied, when I saw that the men were scattering, he's operating in fear again. When I saw the men were scattering, you did not come at the set time, and the Philistines were assembling at Michmash. I thought, now the Philistines will come down against me at Gilgal, and I have not sought the Lord's favor. So I felt compelled to offer the burnt offering. You acted foolishly, Samuel said. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God gave you. If you had... And this is how we can tell. How do we know that he wasn't set up for failure? How do we know that he wasn't just a pawn in this game and that he just happened to be the bad guy in the story? Because some people read the Bible wrong and they'll read the one account and they'll say, well, Saul was just meant to be the bad guy. David was a good guy. And, you know, this philosophy of we can't change our lot in life because that's just the way God ordained it. And I don't believe that at all. You acted foolishly, Samuel said. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God gave you. Here's the big word. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time. But now your kingdom will not endure. The Lord has sought out a man after his own heart and has appointed him leader of his people because you have not kept the Lord's command. It couldn't be more straightforward, but so many people confuse the ways of our God and the ways that he operates with us and what the Bible teaches, I think, over and over and over again, very simply. It's not confusing to me at all. If I do what's commanded to do, if I stay within God's parameters, my life will be fruitful and will go a lot better than if I wander out from under the umbrella protection. And I see it again in the Bible, and I see it right here with Saul. So much so that Saul was promised, not only for him, but his lineage. He could have been the guy who the kingdom was going to pass through down and down and down. But instead, it said, he was disobedient. Now, we're all disobedient to some level. So you say, but we're all sinners. Where do you draw the line here then? In his heart of hearts, he really wasn't on fire and in love with God. He knew God existed, just like we can go all the way back to Genesis and see the same story playing out between the brothers, right? When you see Cain and Abel, we see the same thing. Did they both know God existed? Yes. Did they both know to give a sacrifice? Yes. Did one of them give the best of their sacrifices? Yes. And did the other one give their leftovers to God? Yes. Why? Because either you're fully in love with God and sold out and on fire for him, or you really are just going through the motions. Even as people who believe in God, you could separate the camps, sadly. It wasn't an issue of belief. Where's your heart? And God was saying, where's your heart at? If you really love me, you'll obey me. and you'll stick with me. But he could see in the heart of Saul a guy that would constantly compromise and was always going to backpedal on things because his heart was not sold out. He was not a man of faith. He was a man of fear. He was always going to function based on his fears. And as a fearful man, he was always going to fall prey to the enemies. So he was disobedient. He was unfaithful. His heart was not right with God. He operated out of fear, and a lot of that fear was actually of his own people, sadly. It wasn't even the enemies that were around him. Ultimately, he was even afraid of his own people. In chapter 15 and verse 10, then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, I am grieved that I have made Saul king because he has turned away from me and has not carried out my instructions. Samuel was troubled and he cried out to the Lord all that night. Samuel believed in what God had done, and like us, he just wanted to stick with the guy, and he wanted to say, man, I really care about this guy, and I care about Israel. I care about what's going on, and I don't want this guy to fall, and I'm the one that anointed him, and I kissed him when I anointed him with the oil, and I prayed over this guy, and I believed in him, and I've seen him do great victories, and a lot of the people love him, and they love his family, and we love this story about him raising up out of this small tribe of the Benjamites and becoming the king, and I don't want to give up on him. But God's like, no. It's not that I don't love him anymore. It's not that he is not going to be remembered for a lot of the good things he's done. And it's not like he's never done anything good in his life. He did a lot of great things. But actions have consequences. It doesn't mean that God stops loving you because he punishes you. He loves you so much that he will chastise you to help you to get obedient again. And sometimes it's a heavy weight to bear. Because sometimes our consequences are heavy because our actions are very disobedient. And those of you that have children know exactly what I'm talking about. You love your child too much to let them run into the street and get hit by a car. And if they show at an early age that their tendency is to run in the street, that you are going to break that habit they have. Even if it means popping them on the butt, contrary to what society teaches us is right and wrong, we're going to do whatever it takes to save their life. Whatever it takes. And if we see that willfulness and that drive and desire, then, you know, sometimes we're going to let them touch the hot stove so that they know. When you touch the hot stove, your hand gets burned and it's painful. But it's better than what could happen down the road if we never teach consequences, if we never allow our kids to touch the hot stove or get a pop. We see those kids too grow up in adults that drive us crazy, right? Because they walk around like everything should be handed to them and there are no consequences, and why in the world am I getting fired from a job for not doing the right thing? And it's like, because you don't do your job. Yeah, but nobody ever taught me that, you know, I never had consequences before, and I've only been late once a week. The other 4 days, I'm always on time. Sorry. Consequences. Right? Where do we get all that? I see all you amening, nodding your head. Where do we get this concept? Because it's biblical. Because God has wired that into us as followers of his. We all resonate this with this. We love it more when I'm talking about it in relationship to our kids. It's not as fun when I start drilling down on us, which we will continue to do. And no, you can't get up and go. No. I won't read the rest of that, but suffice it to say that ultimately God walks through this with him. And another one of my favorite passages in how Saul replies to the situation with Samuel replies to the situation with Saul that I described to you earlier, about him wanting to take stuff for fear of the people, and they take the animals and stuff like this. And another favorite passage, one that we have songs written about because it's so relevant to our lives, in verse 22 of chapter 15, but Samuel replied, does the Lord delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as obeying the voice of the Lord? To obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and arrogance like the evil of idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord, he has rejected you as king. See, ultimately, it wasn't a one-time offense. God knew his heart. He had rejected the word of the Lord that had come through Samuel and had come through previous scriptures, the lessons that were already taught to him. He had rejected that. He was going to continue to live this life of rebellion, and God saw him in a rebellious spirit, and he just said, no, you've been rejected as king. I'm going to raise up somebody, not who's bigger, not who's stronger, not who's a better general, not who has that type of pedigree, not who comes from a bigger and better family, not who's the oldest of the family, the firstborn, the driven, the type A. No. I have one thing I'm looking for. Don't you love it? Don't you love it? A man after my own heart. That's it. I need a man after my own heart. You're not him. But I have found him. And Samuel doesn't even know what to do with this information. In one of the saddest passages of Scripture, it says, the Spirit leaves Saul. As I said, it was just for a time. He would have stayed with them through the end, but the Spirit leaves Saul. Second one is David starts off small, but he finishes big. So David starts off small, but he finishes big. Can't possibly do the whole life story of David, one of my favorite characters in the Bible, somebody who I relate to a ton, who I absolutely love, but we'll go through this a little bit. So in chapter 16, I want to give you plenty of scriptures, even if we can't drill down on them as much as I'd like to. But in chapter 16, 6 through 11, it says, when they arrived, this is Samuel arriving after being told by God what he was supposed to do. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed stands here before the Lord. So he's given an instruction, you need to go to this family, and yeah, it's in Bethlehem, and who's in Bethlehem? You know, Bethlehem's this little town outside Jerusalem, big deal. What's going on in Bethlehem? And yes, that's where you're going to find the new king, and you're going to anoint him, and he's going to be a son of Jesse. And so the son of Jesse stands before him, and Samuel takes one look at Eliab, and Samuel's still functioning in his previous thinking because he looks at this guy, and he's pretty big, he's pretty strong, he has the look we're looking for. But God hasn't spoken blessing over that. That's just his thinking, and sometimes our thinking is thinking, and we need to get God's thinking to get on the right track. So he needed to get his own thinking out of the way. And sometimes we need to tell our own brain, shut up for a minute. Stop going that route because God doesn't seem to be going that way. God's actually going this way, contrary to the way that we would want to do it. And yes, even Samuel, a prophet of God, had his own plan, had his own way, right in the midst of walking with God as a prophet. Think about that. Before you idolize too much these characters of the Bible, these awesome people who we look forward to meeting in heaven someday, certainly I do, like Samuel, he's a human being like you. Okay, God, I've got the instructions now, I'll figure it out from here. Slow down, Samuel. That doesn't work so hot. Back it up. That's not the guy. When they arrived, Samuel saw Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed stands here before us. But the Lord said to Samuel, spoke in his ear, whatever that still quiet voice, however he did it, do not consider his appearance or his height, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. Good word. Then Jesse called Abinadab, and had him pass in front of Samuel, but Samuel said, the Lord has not chosen this one either. So at this point, Samuel has, if you wonder what's happening in the spiritual realm, we see this transition from Samuel thinking with his own brain to slowing that voice down, telling his own brain, shut up, and listening for the still small voice of the Lord speaking. Because I know sometimes we read this, we wonder, how is this playing out? And can this work in my own life? And God doesn't speak to me in the clouds, and I've never heard a voice just suddenly speaking in the room. How does God do this? Well, if you slow down, it says, be still and know that he is God. So when Samuel got that word, the way I read it, he slowed down and he started listening. And as he listened and as he humbled himself and realized, I don't got this, I got to listen, God started speaking. And suddenly with authority, he starts saying, nope, 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 nope. He's like, okay, red light, red light, red light, red light. Now I'm getting it. I'm seeing it in my mind's eye. Red light, red light, red light. Okay, I'm going to wait until the green light this time. I'm not going to speak out presumptively. Here's the guy. No, no, no. That was bad. Let's wait till God gives the green light. And then we'll speak, right? You resonate with this? This making sense? Thank you, Mike. I'm glad it makes sense to you, at least. Jesse called Abinadab and had him pass in front of Samuel, but Samuel said, the Lord has not chosen this one either. Jesse then had Shammah pass by, but Samuel said, nor has the Lord chosen this one. Jesse had seven of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to him, the Lord has not chosen these. So he asked Jesse, are these all the sons that you have? This is such a weird, awesome story. I love it. There is still the youngest, Jesse answered. And I want to say that I believe it came across like this. But he's tending the sheep. I gave you the prime cuts of my stock. I pulled out the best arrows in my quiver. I showed you, but yeah, there's David, but he's a sheep tender. He's a little guy. He's still a teenager. Let's get this guy. Let me meet David. He knows he's there for a purpose, and Samuel's not going to be content till he figures this out. Samuel said, send for him. We will not sit down until he arrives. We will not sit down until he arrives. No procrastinating. No trying to talk me out of this. You know, sometimes people are going to just try to wear you out or say, he's like, no, let me put it this way. We're not sitting down until he arrives. So I'll stand here all day. I've got all day. I'm not moving until David gets here. So, okay, I guess you're serious. So he sent and he had him brought. He was ruddy with a fine appearance and handsome features. Then the Lord said, rise and anoint him. He is the one.